Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to this free episode of Dunked On. Nate and Danny are going to go over Lakers-Nuggets Game 3 and do their 76ers and Warriors offseason previews. This is just a sample of the type of content you can get at Dunked On, the in-depth game coverage, the large picture look-aheads at each team's offseason. This is just the start. They're going to chronicle every team's offseason. So if you want to get all that content through the rest of the playoffs into the summer as they cover the deals that have yet to happen, and get into team situations, see what their possibilities are. Then, of course, as the summer gets really going, the deals that actually happen. You want all that coverage? Subscribe to Dunked On Prime at dunkedon.supportingcast.fm. dunkedon.supportingcast.fm.
Well, in a lot of ways, everything went right for the LA Lakers tonight. The whistles were going their way in the third quarter. They took a lot more free throws than Denver. They got 28 shots at the rim to Denver's 15. Denver struggled in the paint, 6 of 18. And even on a night when not much was going right for Denver, they managed to persevere and win this one, taking what in theory was the Lakers' best and final shot to win it rather comfortably in the end, 119-108.
There is a fair amount to unravel in this contest, but in some ways I think of it a little bit like Game 2 of the East Finals, which we discussed, where there isn't as much of a dominant like overall storyline, but there are some important elements to this. And for me,
can I say one overall storyline?
Sure.
The Denver Nuggets are very good at shooting the basketball and the LA Lakers are not.
True. And the game where Denver had their worst shooting game on shots outside the paint, Lob Murray did a stat on this, that the worst game for Denver was Game 2, but the Lakers were even worse. So they were 35.6% in that one, whereas they've been 45 and 55 in the other two, 55 in Game 1 where they couldn't miss anything, and then 45 tonight. And that gives a huge margin for error to the Denver Nuggets. And it's been a fascinating series in terms of like the guys who can and cannot stay on the floor. And like we'll talk about Aaron Gordon and D'Angelo Russell inevitably. And for Denver, like there haven't been as many stretches as I thought like was like if you're like, OK, they're going to be up 3-0 in the series. It's going to be like the battle stations fully operational, all that type of stuff, like full bore. And Jamal Murray was that in the first half of this game, you know, 30 points, 13 to 20 from the field. He was 13 of his first 15, making everything, some tough shots, some easy ones too. And during that stretch, Jokic largely like kind of stepped back on it. He had 5 points in the first half, 2 of 8 from the field, missed a lot of twos. And then Jamal Murray was pretty dang cold the rest of the game. In the second half, he shot 2 of 9 overall, had 5 assists.
The crazy stat on that was that Murray made 13 of his first 15.
And then went.
He then proceeded to miss 10 straight.
Yeah.
But other guys stepped up. And I broke in there. But yeah, like his first half is a huge part of the story. Again, he's been over 30 in every game.
And then Jokic had a pretty weak first half. And then he dealt with foul trouble, only played 4.5 minutes of the third quarter, which ended up being that post Jokic time was decisive. And then Jokic played the entire fourth, 15 points. 2 rebounds, 2 assists, +9 as the Nuggets put their close to finishing touches on this series.
Yeah, I think this maybe the best way to go through this a little bit is chronologically. And The Lakers, we've seen them in basically every game they've played in the actual playoffs get off to a good start at home. And they were not able to do that in this game. The Nuggets basically had a 10-point lead before they could yank D'Angelo Russell off the floor. And so that to me was a big theme, and it took place in the second half as well, that Darvin Ham started Russell. All right, that's forgivable to me at home. I think he's largely been better at home. Their offense wasn't very good last game. But I think the bigger problem with Russell, and you could point to the fact that his offense was bad. He was 1-8, 1-6 from three on good looks, which you think he was 0-3 on corner threes, I want to say. Like, all of them were pretty good looks that he needs to knock those down to have 3 points on 1-8. It was just a disaster. Negative 12, 3 turnovers. And the defensive component wasn't amazing. Like, there were a few times early where Murray was able to get started by getting him screened on and then running pick and roll with Jokic, and they got good stuff out of that. But the bigger problem I found was just that it messed up their matchups a lot, particularly because they also weren't willing to start off with LeBron guarding Nikola Jokic. I thought that worked great last game, but I think they felt like he was too tired. Also, I think that second ankle sprain that he got in the last game, I think he wasn't quite at the same level that he was in that game too, when he was just unbelievable defensively. So if you're going to start Russell rather than Hachimura, now you're left with Anthony Davis having to guard Jokic to start. And that basically every moment that Anthony Davis has guarded Jokic, they've gotten completely smoked. And so little of it is about, oh, Nikola Jokic, yeah, he's just going to score on AD whenever he wants to. It has nothing to do with that. Like, I think it just, if AD is going to guard in the post, that's fine. Like, if Jokic wants to go at AD in the post, if that's all it was, like, I think the Lakers might be okay with that. But of course, that's not all it is. Like, there are going to be double teams there, maybe over helping, in fact. But there's also the pick and roll game. And then there's also the fact that if Anthony Davis is guarding Jokic in the main action, there's no Anthony Davis behind him. LeBron was not able to provide that level of rim protection. If you can, maybe nobody can. So it's all the ancillary stuff that keeping Davis off of Jokic prevents, right? Like, they don't get any back cuts, really, as if Davis is on Aaron Gordon, who again was pretty terrible spacing out, I thought, and didn't close the game, which we'll talk about more. So you take away the back cuts. Offensive rebounds, like, you have number one, you're not giving up nearly as many layups because they're just not even willing to challenge AD. Those are the easiest plays to offensive rebound. AD's not like getting stuck having to box out Jokic, and so he can rebound out of his area. And he's just generally more in position. There's no need for him to stick to Jokic as someone like, say, Murray drives. And so you clean up the offensive glass as well. And then, of course, anytime somebody tries to drive, or even Jokic posting up, like, you know that you can't just put a guy in the goal if you're Nikola Jokic, because AD is going to come over there and help. So it's just, it knocks out so many things. It's not about, oh, AD can't guard Jokic. And then, of course, he also, I would also say that the Nuggets pick and roll game is way better when AD is not involved in it, because AD is still waiting there at the rim. And now you can just stick, Hachimura can stick to Jokic, and then Murray, even if he gets free, which he did some, he's not going to be able to get all the way for the rim for a layup. So there are just so many reasons why that was a better strategy that I still don't think the Nuggets ever solved, but they're going to win this series without having solved it, in part because the Lakers just didn't go to it enough. And at the start of the first and the start of the third, with Russell on the floor and not being willing to put James on Jokic, they also started Vanderbilt as well, which, you know, you can question at this point too, but they started with, they felt they were too small with D'Lo and with Schroeder out there, so they couldn't do that either. But I think the ultimate lesson then is the Nuggets and their personnel were able to render enough of what the Lakers wanted to do inoperable that they were still in command in this series, even if the Lakers did find this one strategy that worked pretty well.
That's fair. And the nature of, like, you can turn to other people. And I do think that Darvin Ham could have moved away from D'Angelo Russell more thoroughly. And
he had to do it at the start of the second. Like, that's when it was just ridiculous.
Because, yeah, things had gone so much better. I mean, Russell, they were out, and not all of this goes on Russell's shoulders, but they were outscored by 12 points when Russell was on the floor, and they were +9 when he sat, which is pretty striking. And then Russell comes out in the third quarter, and they're about even, but that wasn't enough to kind of make up the gap. And then with Russell, it's always been this story, and it's, you and I have been at different points, you know, we've been consistent in Russell, but other people have moved around us. And the question for me has always been, is he good enough on offense to make up for it on defense? And part of what was interesting but also awkward about the Lakers fit is that he's put in a better situation to succeed. Russell can be an adept off-ball player, and I think he's overtaxed a little bit as the like dominant offensive force. Like the pick and roll engine isn't really his best role. However, that also means, and this is I think where the Lakers should have ended up if they, you know, other than the personal dynamics, which we can maybe discuss, with even if you want LeBron to have the ball in his hands less and tired and everything like that, reasonable, though especially LeBron had 12 assists and only 2 turnovers in game 3. The less you lean on Russell, the less practical it is to have him on the floor, because a higher portion of what he has to do is defense. And he's still very bad at that. We, you know, even after Bruce Brown said everything, you did have a Russell had a block on Brown in game 2.
I didn't think that Russell was like even actively bad defensively.
He had a couple of bad possessions, but not nearly as egregious as the Denver game.
No, he wasn't. And the Lakers transition defense overall was just much better. And that helped Russell because he wasn't kind of just stuck out on an island defending in transition.
But the practical challenge for the Lakers, and this is a good problem for them to have, is that some of their other guys have stepped up and are doing better. So like Austin Reeves can create more. He doesn't always add more, but he takes a lot less off. And when you have LeBron and AD, you can work with that. And at times, Schroeder works well. At times, Rui Hachimura works well. At times, Lonnie Walker works well, as of course he did in game 4 against the Warriors. And I thought he played reasonably well in his 19 minutes in game 3. And so you have all these different forces in play. And there's also the factor that in this specific matchup against this specific opponent, it's a hard series for D'Angelo Russell. But you have to weigh these things out. He is a pending unrestricted free agent. You, in many ways, committed to this path to at least some degree when you traded for him and all these other players who had 2023 elements of their contracts, that it was better to stay over the cap. They are not bound by that, but it is more logical based on the moves that Rob Pelinka made, which overall worked out extremely well. So per Dave McMenamin's reporting, there's this idea that the Lakers need to keep Russell engaged, even though this is a bad series for him. And it's an unenviable position for Darvin Ham, for sure. And he's not the person negotiating the next contract with D'Lo anyway. He's not the person who traded for him either. But LeBron is 38 years old, and you know, Denver wins the first 2 games. They're in a good place in the series. At a certain point, you need to do what's right for the team, and Russell being out there was a problem. And if he's not willing to accept that, at a certain point, you have to be able to deal with that.
Yeah, one of the other things you can kind of point to is, you know, Murray was just going crazy, right? Like, he's hitting all these mid-rangers, then he's banging threes in the second quarter, and the Nuggets, I thought they really were at their best when the Lakers tried to go to the strategy that I think they were believing would work the best for them. And they had a lineup, I think it was Walker, Reeves, Hachimura, LeBron, AD. And the Nuggets actually carved that up. They tried to go to switching the Murray and Jokic actions, and then also having AD still behind the play. And the Nuggets carved that up. Hachimura in particular really struggled with the communication, and the Nuggets were doing a great job of attacking the mesh point of that screen, whether it was going into the body of the guy who is switching, getting 2 on the ball even though they didn't want it, getting Jokic slipping to the rim. There was Murray getting AD onto him because AD was also involved in switching everything when they would get Gordon or Jeff Green involved. And then Murray got AD onto him, fakes towards the screen. Then as soon as AD is about to switch, he goes back the other way, gets an open 3 in his face. So there are a lot of plays where they got like quick slips. They caused miscommunications. Jokic was throwing great passes, and they made the Lakers get out of that strategy. That wasn't going to work, particularly not with Murray playing the way that he was. So then they got to go back to Dennis Schroeder. Like, okay, all right, I guess, like, is this going to work? Like, Murray did beat him up earlier in the series. Schroeder was unbelievable. His off-ball defense on Murray, all these little like zoom actions that they run, Murray setting a back screen. They had something for that too, where they had somebody come off the weak side corner to take away Gordon off that Murray back screen, and then Murray would pop out. Like, Schroeder is just bumping him every single time. He's doing an amazing job. Like, I just, as we were doing the live show, I'm just locked in on watching this battle between Murray and Schroeder off the ball. And I will credit the Nuggets actually for having a lot better actions than Golden State. Now, that helps that they have an amazing passer who can also score in Jokic, running everything, but the stuff that the Nuggets run to get Murray open with more back screening, more screens for him into a handoff. And it also helps that Murray is like, has more size, can turn the corner, go to a mid-ranger as well, whereas Steph is not really as powerful once he gets the guy on his back. But the Nuggets off-ball stuff worked much better than the Warriors stuff did against the Lakers. But Schroeder was fantastic. Like, he finally slows Murray down. He misses his last five of the half. Then Vanderbilt's doing a pretty good job at the start of the second. He misses another five in a row. But then the problem is the Lakers can't score because you've got LeBron on the floor. You've got Schroeder on the floor. And now all the pick and rolls, the Lakers were getting good looks pretty early on when they had more of their offensively focused starting lineup out there. Like in pick and roll, they grow cold when Schroeder comes in, and they're also just gapping off LeBron. Jeff Green in particular, when he was guarding LeBron, did a great job of just LeBron's above the arc and Jeff Green's all the way down at the dotted line, like messing up Anthony Davis, cutting off drives. Like the Lakers want to run all these side pick and rolls with like Austin Reeves and Davis, and like Green's way down there messing things up. They're not guarding Schroeder either. So for the Lakers, like, okay, they have a unit, Schroeder on Murray. You still got Davis guarding Gordon. Like, that's enough to actually slow the Nuggets down. But then they can't score. And even if the Nuggets aren't getting great shots, they still got really good shot makers on this team who are going to knock enough down that the Nuggets still were mostly in command.
Oh, it is that time again. Wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom near you, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guy can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion. But you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar Capspace code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O. Indochino.com. Don't forget that Capspace code to let them know you came from us. Renters, you ever feel like you're stuck in this loop of rent payments, just watching your money vanish into thin air? It's time to turn that rent game around and start earning some serious rewards. That's where Built Rewards comes in. Built is breaking ground as the first rewards program that hooks you up with points on your rent. Even if you're still rocking the old school rent check vibes, Built Rewards has got your back. They'll mail the check for you. It's like having a personal rent paying assistant. Every month, pay your rent and watch the Built points roll in. Use points to jet off on a dream vacation. Put your points towards a flight or hotel stay with 500 plus airlines and 700,000 plus hotels and properties. You can also use your points towards a future rent payment or towards a future down payment on a home. Pay rent hassle-free through the Built Rewards app. Your rent game just got a major upgrade. Earn points by paying rent right now when you go to joinbuilt.com/capspace. That's joinbuilt, B-I-L-T, joinbuilt.com/capspace. Don't forget that /capspace URL.
Yeah, and for the Lakers to swing the part of the possession game, so they swung the offensive rebound portion of it, and if you want the clean the glass version of it, 28 offensive rebound rate versus 16 in favor of the Lakers. And when you consider how they got housed in game one, that's a pretty stark turn of events. But the Lakers didn't force any turnovers. It was only 5 in total for Denver, and 3 of those were live ball steals. And yeah, the Lakers didn't score particularly. They scored all right on those. But it was
If you look at the math things that we look at, right? No offensive rebounds for Denver, which you mentioned, not getting any shots at the rim, not really getting to the free throw line particularly impressively, and a lot of that came late once the game was pretty much out of reach. So there are really only two things that were working great for Denver in the end. It was making difficult outside shots. They had to take 41 threes, which is way more than they normally like to, because they just weren't getting stuff at the rim. And then that big thing you mentioned, not turning it over, and the Lakers generally don't force turnovers. And
I would add transition to that, make it a trio.
Okay, sure. Yeah, yeah. Although, yeah, I didn't think that. Yeah, they did actually get a bunch of semi-transition even in that third quarter, too. I mean, because that's the other key stretch we need to talk about, I think, is just Jokic getting his fourth foul on what was a good call, by the way. A lot of people didn't think so, but Jokic's leg did clip Davis and took his legs out from under him. It's a pretty clear foul. That challenge was overruled. And so, like, all right, Jokic is out. LeBron and AD in. Like, they left those guys in there for most of the time as well. And the Nuggets managed to maintain their lead.
And they managed to maintain it despite some of the great ball pressure work you already brought up Schroeder and Vanderbilt did. And that short circuit things even more remarkably when Jokic is off the floor, because you don't really have those other things to turn to.
Yeah, because it wasn't Murray. Murray didn't do anything in the third quarter at all.
Instead, it was that was a big quarter for Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. He hit a couple of really hard shots, was overall was 3 of 5 from 3, a couple of big MPJ buckets. And it was also getting some stops. I mean, the Lakers were 3 of 9 from 3, 10 to 23 from the field during that. So getting enough offense, getting enough defense. And that to me was the stretch where I'm like, okay, if things, because in the early part of it, it seemed like so many things were going great for Denver, especially Jamal Murray, you know, 30 points in the first half, and the Lakers were close. And so you're like, oh, that's trouble for Denver. Then after the third quarter, you're like, oh, they faced some real adversity here. They got through it pretty clean. That's a problem for the Lakers. Then it didn't really fully resolve until midway through the fourth quarter. And one of the other key swings in that fourth quarter to connect with one of the storylines in this series is that Aaron Gordon didn't play a single second.
And it was Jeff Green instead. Green, as I mentioned, I thought he actually was doing pretty well on defense. And I think, the other reason why it really mattered that Schroeder was on the floor is that Murray was guarding him and the Lakers really couldn't put Murray in the action. Like, they had a lot of success with LeBron going at him. They may also have just felt like LeBron just didn't have it with the ankle or whatever, but you didn't see, they couldn't like go at Murray and like tire him out and get him in foul trouble or anything like that either when he was cooking so badly, because Schroeder, isn't really useful as a role man. And then on the other end, not only is Jeff Green doing a good job as a help defender, which is the first time in my life I've ever said that, LeBron's not really able to cook him one-on-one. And then just even the ability for him to stand in the corner and shoot open corner threes, which he's been doing really well since his Houston days, that was enough, I think, for them to decide once they're down by like, 8 or so, to put Anthony Davis back on Jokic. And then Jokic went to this 5-1 pick and roll with Murray that the Lakers didn't have any kind of an answer for either, because, Davis is way out on the floor. They get Murray slipping to the rim. He scores a beautiful reverse over Austin Reeves, who you don't really want as like the low man in help defense with Davis out on the floor. I don't know why it was that they went back to that. I guess because maybe they're like, all right, we're going down with our best defender on Jokic. Or maybe it was because they felt like Jeff Green in the corner was causing too many problems for Davis just hanging out or whatever. But that definitely was not the right answer, because as noted, every single time Davis was on Jokic in the series, they got killed, and they did again.
Gordon also is a part of Denver's best defensive lineups, but laying off LeBron, and LeBron, we can talk about it as being part of the injury or anything else, like LeBron not exploiting that made it even more realistic. And so in this game, I always talk about the ratio of LeBron's jump shots to paint shots. Like, we'll use that as the shorthand as being a good proxy for the kind of performance he's having. In game three, LeBron takes 11 shots as jumpers, makes 4 of those 11. And then he takes 8 shots in the paint and only makes 4 of those 8. So he's 50%, 50% in one area and below 50 in the other. And it's more jumpers than shots around the basket. And part of that was because they were clogging things up. And I mean, he's 3 of 9 from 3. You don't necessarily want to fire him away. He had some gorgeous, gorgeous passes in this game. And it's jarring to see it. And like the idea, it came up at times in the Memphis series of like the Lakers winning games and winning series where LeBron James is not their best player. And he's had some great moments overall in the series, especially defense in game two. But to see an opponent win in part because they were bending their scheme to exploit a limitation of LeBron James is surreal.
And both the Grizz and the Warriors tried to do it. It just didn't work. Not even because LeBron was killing them from the outside, although LeBron did shoot pretty well in the Warriors series at times. And despite all this, the Lakers are up 94-93 with 7:48 left. Then this is where having Jeff Green out there really pays off. Jokic gets double teamed in the post and he's able to find someone on the weak side. They Bruce Brown, who swings it to Jeff Green. AD was hanging out under the basket, was not able to get all the way over there. So Green hits a corner three. Lonnie Walker misses a corner three. Bruce Brown comes right back and makes a three. Nuggets are all of a sudden up five. Lakers timeout. LeBron back in. LeBron throws an incredible alley-oop to AD. And I thought AD got fouled on that play, but we never really saw a replay of it. LeBron was like shooting a fadeaway jumper and like passed it to AD above the rim. And then AD also missed the offensive rebound. And then they come back. And I think this one, this was the play that I thought was maybe the key shot. 5-point Nuggets lead. Dennis Schroeder is guarding Jamal Murray. Bruce Brown has the ball. Jokic is jogging up to the top to set a screen for Bruce Brown on the ball. And Schroeder kind of sees Jokic jogging up there and decides that he's just going to kind of just like step in front of Jokic and like try to fall down and draw a foul. As Jokic is just like jogging up to set a screen, completely independent of Schroeder. Schroeder never gets in front of him, flops down, no call. Jamal Murray wide open. Bruce Brown just throws it to him. He hits a three. They're up eight. And that was basically the game.
It also like, I mean, at first we thought it was a bad no call against the Lakers. But when you saw it more on the replay, you could see that Schroeder was anticipating it, was kind of even bent over in anticipation. It would have been Jokic's fifth foul. And
yeah, and I thought that was a great, I got fooled and the referees didn't. So I'll give them a lot of credit for it.
Another storyline or like key element of this game was in the second quarter, Jokic got on the edge of foul trouble. He at that point had two, and basically for the entire rest of the second quarter did not really contest any shots around the basket. And Jokic is not a great help defender. We've criticized him for it a lot in the past, but I appreciated what he does more in absentia, because in the second quarter, like, he just wasn't like even like getting close to anybody who drove by. And then, you know, he's doing all this effort, and, you know, I always talk about how star players, you know, avoiding foul trouble is extremely valuable. Jokic is doing that. Then he picks up his third in an offensive action. He fouls Austin Reeves and picks up that third foul just at the very, very end of the second quarter. And then that sets up the foul trouble, which shaped the third.
Yeah, but in the end, not quite enough. And yeah, the Lakers have defended well enough these last two games to win. They just were not able to score well enough. I mean, Bruce Brown just continues to be really good. And I've noted it's a totally different role for him than the one that he played in Brooklyn, where he's more on ball, particularly in transition. He's been great. And he had 15 points again. Like, you just don't, that wasn't what I think people were expecting Bruce Brown to do. He had a couple of just like big tip-ins as well. Basically the only offensive rebounds that the Nuggets were getting were through him. Porter Jr., 6 assists, career high.
Mm-hmm.
4 of 10 from 3, only took 1 2-point field goal, which he missed. Didn't take any non-jumpers, but just another guy that you can't leave, and they can run some actions for him going to his left and on some of those handoffs every now and again. And really none of the Lakers guards, this is another key difference from the Golden State series, that other than Austin, like, Russell and Schroeder have both done absolutely nothing offensively in the series, whereas they were lighting up Golden State. And again, just credit the Nuggets for their strategy of just not guarding guys, packing the paint like crazy. And you can also say, if you're comparing the Nuggets performance to Golden State, the Lakers made a ton of shots against Golden State that they're not making in this series. And you can also say that the Nuggets are making a ton of shots that Golden State was getting some pretty good shots too, and like Klay Thompson just couldn't hit any of them. But like, that's, the Nuggets have been a great shooting team all season. Like, they've been able to continue that, and they have multiple guys who are going to be able to knock down these shots. Murray can get to tough mid-rangers as well. And so they just have Jokic. If he can get in the post, he's still an amazing passer. They've seen basically every strategy to try to slow them down. Like, yes, putting the best defensive player in the world standing under the basket and having the guy he's guarding also standing under the basket wasn't the best. But aside from that, the fact that the Nuggets have still been able to overcome that has been pretty impressive, and a testament to the amount of talent that they have. What else do we need to talk about here? I think I'm pretty much out of gas at this point.
Changes that the Lakers can make. We've brought up the Anthony Davis on Jokic part of it. There are a couple different ways they could get there. It could be starting Rui Hachimura. That's presumably the way I would go there. you could also do it through, presumably you could change, configure the lineups a little differently and use Vando more as a help defender rather than the primary on Jamal. Or you could also start Schroeder and do some of that kind of stuff. But D'Angelo Russell, I
mean, they can't play Vando and Schroeder together is the problem.
That's a good point.
But that three-pointer in the corner that Vando missed might have it might have like injured a courtside fan. That thing was ugly. I don't know. What else can they do? Anything that comes to mind? I think we've hit on most of it here.
I mean, just one thing, because I forgot it. We saw very little Christian Brown in this game. He only played 3 minutes, and that was something you and I expected after what happened in game two. And the answer was not playing someone else. It wasn't Najee or Watson or Chanchar or Thomas Bryant or Reggie Jackson. It was just play Bruce Brown and Jeff Greenmore. And that worked out. That worked out pretty dang well for the Nuggets.
Yeah. And I will definitely credit Malone for hitting the right buttons with the like Brown or Porter Jr. decision. And then also the Green versus Gordon decision. That's something that we had brought up of like, hey, should they do this? Since Green is I don't think he shot a much better percentage than Aaron Gordon on corner threes. But the thing is like Jeff Green is out there to shoot a corner three. Aaron Gordon, the way he's played all year, he's trying to duck in. He's trying to get some offensive rebounds. He doesn't want to just go stand in the corner. Whereas sometimes you just need to do that. You're like, they have other guys who can run all the main action. Sometimes you need someone who's just going to stay out of the way. Like Aaron Gordon just doesn't want to do that. And so like we didn't even see whether he's going to make any of these corner threes because he's taken what, like two over the last two games, despite the fact that he's being guarded in this way. So yeah, all right. I think just like someone who actually was just willing to do less on offense and not just like hang around all the time right in the area where it's mucking everything up was pretty useful. So yeah, I mean, maybe the Lakers win game four, Nuggets drop game four to Minnesota in the first round, although it was that crazy comeback that almost was. They got into overtime and then Minnesota won it. And you could even see the Lakers like playing pretty well in game five, but this is an insurmountable lead.
Right. For like, reason. I don't think it has to be a four game sweep, but it would be stunning for it to be a seven game series, much less a win for the Lakers.
Well, considering it's only happened three times that a 3-0 lead has gotten a seven, and of course, nobody has ever actually overcome it. Yeah, it seems pretty unlikely. It'll happen this time. And I'll be interested to see what LeBron's effort level is in game NAD2, probably in game four, where they know they're not going to win the series. I mean, is there going to be like a lot of pride to continue it? Like LeBron definitely, as I've said, is judicious about his effort, and he's never been swept. Oh yeah, he has been swept. He's been swept once, which was in 2018, I think. Oh, and the 2007 Spurs in the finals. I think those are the only two times he's been swept. And I will say, I don't think he was at the same level. You would question them not putting him on Jokic. Again, I guess they were just too worried about their offense, particularly if they're also going to have a shooter out there. Like if LeBron is not going to be able to really be an offensive engine at the end of the game, which he was exhausted in game two. So, I mean, that's what happens when you're 38. There's nobody in the world who can give the type of defensive effort I think that he gave, certainly not at 38, like guarding like a post player like Jokic, doing all the switching he was doing, running around after everyone, and also still be an unbelievable offensive force. Like there are so few guys in NBA history who've been able to do that in the modern era. You know, maybe you could point to like Kawhi at the end of that series against Luka in 2021. I mean, there just are not. And like Jimmy, he'll be involved sometimes guarding the main guys, but he also doesn't have the same type of an offensive role as like peak LeBron would, controlling everything. I've been very impressed given his health situation and his age, what LeBron's been able to do in these playoffs. Like I've gotten every Lakers series that I've picked these playoffs wrong. I finally came around to them and now they're about to get swept. Yeah, this has easily been my worst ever predictions, but and Hollinger's got it right. He was one of the few, I think, who picked Denver to make it to the finals, and that's going to happen. Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now. 10 years later. You might be like, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long with Helix. Better sleep starts now.
So I will be honest, I tend to pack on the pounds a little bit during the winter, holiday season, not getting outside as much. So in springtime, I try to eat healthier, and I'm really excited to try Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Each meal is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. This is going to be fantastic for me during the playoffs, when a lot of times I feel like I don't have time to eat healthy, and now I can choose from a number of their delicious but healthy options. I like to go keto. On occasion, they have that. They have vegan and veggie options as well. Here's what they've got for their keto weekly menu this week. Sun-dried tomato chicken with zucchini noodles, spicy poblano beef bowl with roasted broccoli, chicken piccata with cauliflower mash and broccoli, or if you want to go their chef's choice weekly menu, jalapeno lime cheddar chicken. That sounds fantastic. Greek lemon chicken with roasted potatoes. This all sounds really, really good. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up, heat, and savor the good stuff. And they're also celebrating Earth Day all month long as well. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/dunked50, special code for this one. That's factormeals.com/dunked50, and use the code dunked50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's code dunked50 at factormeals.com/dunked50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right, Mr. LaRue, it is time to do some stretching, warm up a little bit, and make sure that these long disused muscles are ready to go. Talking about the offseason and these brilliant playoffs and all the strategy. Who cares? So boring. To the spreadsheets.
Yeah, we're going to start it out with a team where there's a lot to discuss, and that is the Philadelphia 76ers. And part of the reason there's a lot to discuss with Philly are they have some high-profile decisions to make, not only in the near term, but also thinking a little bit more broadly. They have the newly minted regular season MVP in Joel Embiid. They also have been eliminated from the playoffs in 7 games by the Boston Celtics. And some of the basic elements in play for Philly that are important to remember. So if you count in DeAnthony Melton's $8 million, which is partially guaranteed, but I see no reason why they would do anything other than pick that up. Because remember, in partial guarantee, the only way you get out of that is by waiving them. They're not going to waive DeAnthony Melton. It's not like you can decline it and sign him for a different amount.
It's a great contract at $8
million. Great contract at $8 million. So they're fully guaranteed contracts, not including player options, and Melton, that is a combined $113 million. So that is, in terms of relation to like where the salary cap is supposed to be. So the current projection is 134. So even if you don't count anything for Harden, for House or Harrell or Paul Reed or Jalen McDaniels or Shake Milton or Niang, like they're still like not really like a cap spacey team. Like they could clear a little bit, but not functional space, especially with how big the non-taxpayer mid-level is right now. So like even if they let everything go, but they're not going to let everything go. And so that's a little bit of context for the decisions that Daryl Morey and ownership have to make.
Before we get into the specifics to the Sixers situation, it's important to note again that we have a new CBA, and Larry Kuhn and I discussed in more general terms what these new restrictions are going to mean going forward, including the dreaded second apron. But most of those restrictions kick in for 24-25. Things like not being able to send cash, not being able to aggregate players, not being able to use a trade exception generated by an outgoing sign and trade, the frozen draft pick. None of that stuff happens until the 24-25 season, which is fair, right? A lot of these teams have salaries on the books. The Sixers, if they re-sign Harden, the second apron could potentially come into play. And certainly the first apron could as well. So there aren't as many restrictions, at least for this 1 year. Now, of course, when you consider contracts that might be signed this offseason, you have to consider that in future years after this year, you're going to run into some of these issues, and the draft pick being frozen, the way the tax goes up, really once you're above the $10 million mark over the tax, that starts in the 25-26 season. The rest of these restrictions start in 24-25 that we've mentioned so far. Those all are looming in the background, but also are not necessarily a huge part of this year. So what is then, Danny, what are the restrictions that are new that are coming in that apply just to next year with both the first apron, which is going to be about $7 million above the tax, and the second apron, which is going to be $17.5 million
above the tax. So just to give people an idea of roughly what this is. So we're talking about $169 million in team salary to hit the first apron, because it's 162 is the tax line. And then about 180, it's a little bit above that based on the current projections, to hit the second apron. So the two big things that are new for the upcoming season are for every team that is over the first apron. So this is the equivalent of teams that are over the hard cap. Like it's just labeled differently, but it's that no team that's over the hard cap can sign a player who has been waived who was making more than the non-tax pyramid level. And so that's roughly $12 million. So if Russell Westbrook gets, you know, the equivalent of Russell Westbrook gets waived next year, the equivalent of the Clippers cannot sign. So that's one. The other one is that for teams that are over that second apron, so that's the $17.5 million over about $180 million in salary, that you don't get a tax pyramid level at all. They have weakened the tax pyramid level. It's only $5 million, so it's actually less than the room exception now. But you don't get it at all if you're over the second apron. That's going to be true for the whole CBA.
Yeah, and also worth noting that the taxpayer MLE is now only a 2-year deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the room exception now is increased to $7.6 million. It was in the mid-fives before. And now you can go 3 years on the room exception, but you can only go 2 years on that taxpayer MLE. And there's really only a relatively narrow band in which you can even use the taxpayer MLE. Some teams might do it just to avoid getting hard capped at the first apron by using the full MLE, but it's going to be a lot less useful than it was before. Of course, I will note this, that not that many teams really used the 3-year taxpayer MLE, and when they did, it almost always was a terrible contract. It didn't work out at all. But in any event, so that's kind of what the Sixers are working with. Let's get into their specific situation now, and we'll make the following assumptions. James Harden is going to opt out. That's already been reported. D'Anthony Melton, opt him in to $8 million. Daniel House, player option for 4.3. I think we'll probably opt him in to that. He actually got back in the rotation a little bit in the Celtics series, but didn't have a great year. Not sure how much demand there will be out there for him. And then Montrezl Harrell, also $2.7 million, seems like probably going to opt him in to that. He wasn't really playing. I don't know if he's got a job out there for next year. So that would give them 9 players under contract and have them $37.8 million below the tax, $44.8 million below that first apron, and $55 million below the second apron. If they bring back Harden, I don't really see, because you keep in mind they only have 9 players. So even if they fill in with minimums to get up to 14 or 15, I don't see any way they can pay him anywhere close to market value and still have enough room to stay below that first apron. They're probably looking at really being worried about potentially the second apron. Maybe they could sneak in the tax pyramid level to get another player. But in terms of money, if they bring back Harden, you're not looking at much flexibility unless salary edits are made elsewhere. Before we talk about some of those things, what would you identify as Daryl Morey, assuming you bring back Harden, which, you know, I realize there's some reporting out there that he's not long for this team. He's expected to sign in Houston. Keith Pompey had that. But let's say Harden comes back. What would you consider their primary needs, irrespective of whether there are resources available to actually do anything about it?
I wonder a little bit about it because of how little Daniel House played. But ideally be a player who you respect enough from three that you're going to be guarded, but then also is credible defensively. You know, and honestly, they could be pretty much any size. Like Melton does some of the perimeter stuff, like more perimeter guarding, and they have PJ Tucker still. But I would say that's the, you know, just more bites at that apple, more players that you can fit alongside Harden and Embiid would probably be the biggest thing. Though, it, of course, if they keep Harden, it'll be hard to have real additions.
I said when they brought in Melton, when they brought in Tucker, when they brought in House, although House wasn't as useful in the end, that I thought they had done enough around Joel Embiid and James Harden that if those guys could play well enough, they could really be a contender. And I think even Game 7 showed that was true. Like their role players like kept them in the game for a half there. Like I think they defended reasonably well. It would be hard for me to imagine realistically putting a better supporting cast around those guys. However, there are some things they could shuffle around. The Tobias Harris contract. Tobias Harris over me is finally ending this season, $39.3 million, and potentially could be tradable at that point. I'm not sure what kinds of teams would want Tobias Harris at that number. You still would think some kind of a sweetener would need to be in there to move him for something that's going to help you more. And now there are these new minimum salary requirements, and maybe you could see teams striking out on free agents and being like, yeah, we'll just take Tobias Harris. Sure, why not? And then they maybe even would want to look to re-sign him with bird rights at a better value. But maybe that's more of a question if they lose Harden and then they really want to get into the cap space game. What does Philly have to trade if they wanted to make a move in terms of assets? So we can start with the draft picks. What's available for them to trade once the league year turns over?
They already owe their 23 first round pick to the Jazz for this year. But as you said, if we move past that, then that obligation doesn't count for the Stepien rule. Unfortunately, Philly already owes a lightly protected pick to OKC in 25. So that pick could be conveyed in 25, 26, or 27. And then they owe a subsequent first round pick to Brooklyn, which is, let's call it, roughly 2 years after the other one conveys. So we don't know exactly. So it is difficult for Philadelphia to convey a first round pick, I believe. So basically the first time they could trade one would be 2030, based on the protection on that second pick, the Brooklyn pick.
Yeah, 29 would be potentially the first available draft, but we don't know that.
Yeah, you could do first allowable draft language before that, but for the trade partner to be sure the pick was going to convey.
Yes, because that one to Brooklyn resolves in full by 28. So yeah, only one pick they could give up. How are they fixed for seconds?
Not great on their own. They forfeited their 23 and 24 and traded their 25 and 26. So they're out until 27, but they do have the Knicks in 24 and the Blazers in 29. So if another team was interested in either of those,
yeah, instead, second round picks don't seem to have a lot of currency these days.
They do not. And another challenge for Philly is that they don't really have much in the way of like young players on interesting salaries under contract that they might not want to keep. Like they have Tyrese Maxey, but I don't think they want to trade Tyrese Maxey. And we'll talk about his extension negotiations in a bit. But, you know, like Furkan Korkmaz at 5.4, I don't think of him as a sweetener. I think of him as a player who could potentially be of interest, especially with the new mandatory minimums and all that. I don't think another team is falling all over themselves to get Jaden Springer, who I was actually a little bit surprised that he got that option year picked up. So he's a fully guaranteed 2.2 mil for the upcoming season. So not a lot of flexibility. And like a lot of their other guys are pending free agents of restricted or unrestricted variety. And it's significantly harder to get an asset for them.
So let's talk about Harden then. And first off, you never know whether it's just a leverage play with Harden or whether he, you know, everyone, all the sources are insisting, no, he really wants to go back to Houston. He really wants to go back to Houston. He wants a 4-year deal. We kind of talked about what we'd be comfortable spending on him. We mentioned they got $37 million below the tax, $55 million below the second apron. The max contract, to reiterate, for Harden, you can only get 4 years due to his age and the over 38 rule. But he could get up to 4 years, $210 million. That would start at $47 million. So basically eat up just about all your space above the second apron. And you might even not be able to, unless you dumped someone like Korkmaz or House, avoid going over the second apron, at least at the beginning of the season. If you cleanse by the end, then that's, it doesn't really matter for this year because you only have that issue of not being able to use your tax mid-level. And if you do use your tax mid-level, then you're hard capped to that second apron. But, and then, of course, you run into the issue of Tobias Harris expiring after this year, but then Tyrese Maxey will need a new contract. He'll be at least $30 million a year, you would think, if not more. And so your salary structure is relatively similar going forward. You'd run into those same issues where if you bring back Harden, you know, at something like $40 million a year. Their other problem is that Joel's Supermax extension kicks in this year, so he's making $14 million more than he was before. And then you're really like Maxey, Embiid, Harden, and guys, you know, maybe nobody else making more than $10 million to be below the second apron, which is going to be extremely important. I think Daryl Morey in particular is very concerned about flexibility. Like, he's not going to want to be hamstrung in that way.
You talked about it with Larry and everything, but like the frozen pick is a real restriction for general managers who value flexibility because you can't unfreeze it for 4 years, basically.
Right.
So that's a long, you know, so like once it's done, it's very hard to undo. And that's going to be a real challenge. So yeah, I could, you know, like you and I have been critical of the second apron as functioning like a harder cap. And for certain organizations, whether it be because of ownership's willingness to spend or in certain cases, general manager's willingness to be flexible, that's going to be a real limitation. And so for Harden, there are multiple veto players in this, which is a part of why the negotiation is so compelling. One of those is the Sixers. Like he could have salary demands that they're uncomfortable paying, especially with how that compounds with Embiid and potentially with Tyrese Maxey. The other veto player is Harden. Like there is a possibility, you know, kind of like Jeremy Grant in Denver a couple of years ago, where you make an offer that's competitive, you're a better team than the other suitor that's out there, and it's not good enough. And either one of those things could be the reason that a negotiation falls apart. It could be that the Rockets, you know, money doesn't matter as much to them because they have all these guys on rookie scale contracts. Maybe he'd even take like a richer starting point and then let, you know, over shorter years or descending or something like that, time value money. Or it could be a circumstance where, you know, he talked about freedom and all these other things where he gets more latitude there. So there are a lot of ways it can fail. There's basically one specific way they could succeed. That's just that everybody wants to and they come to agreeable terms. And so I think we've done a pretty good job laying out what Philly can do, you know, what the key players are if Harden resigns, however that happens. And, you know,
well, I do want to hit on one more thing of just
sure.
After this season, if you're going to, because remember, Harden was only making $33 million last year. Joel was only making $33 million last year. And even if they lose Harris, if you have Harden making over $40 million going into the 24-25 season, and then Tyrese Maxey is probably going to start at least $30 million, that's, you don't have a lot left to make your team and stay below that second apron. And that ultimately is what might be scaring Philly off from doing the longer term deal with Harden. Now, Houston, they have nothing on their books other than rookie scale contracts. They don't, not much opportunity cost for them to sign Harden for a couple of years going forward. But for Philly, there is. And if they don't re-sign Harden, then maybe you can use the mid-level for this next year. Maybe you could get off of a little bit of salary and bring in someone who's making like $20 million if you could move on from like Korkmaz and House or something like that. And try to field a competitive team similar to the team that they had without Ben Simmons last year before Harden arrived. You might also say, well, hey, what if they keep Harden and they move Maxey? Like he's only making $4 million next year. So you're not really going to be able to bring it. I mean, unless you attach Maxey to Tobias Harris and somehow that was enough to bring in another star, I don't think it would be.
Especially with their lack of picks.
Right. Yeah. They would have basically one pick that they could include in that trade, that 29 pick that might roll over to 30. So yeah, they're in a really tough spot here. And Joel is starting a 3+1 deal. at the 35% max now. And but when people are like, oh yeah, you know, Joel maybe getting traded, like they're not going to actively look to trade him unless he were to ask out, but they don't have a great path forward here. And Daryl Morey said, hey, you know, if James leaves, we might have to get creative. And could that be something along the lines of a free agent wanting to come to Philly? If Harden leaves, they won't have any issues with the first apron, so they could actually receive a guy in a sign and trade. Maybe Harris is the outgoing salary there. They throw in there first just to give the team that's sending the guy out something. As I scroll through the free agents here, and there really isn't anyone you would look at, I mean, other than like Kyrie Irving, frankly, and Dallas probably wouldn't be participating in a sign and trade there. You know, Chris Middleton, he's got the same problems as Harden, basically, from an age perspective.
Well, and he would be committing to a Philly team that isn't necessarily better, if at all better, than the Bucks.
Or Jeremy Grant, or like there aren't really many guys out there that you could just like bring in free agency and assign and trade to replace Harden.
I want to lay out one other scenario, and that's it's hard for Philly to do. You brought up the stuff they could do in 23 if Harden leaves. There would be some options in 24 because that's when Harris's contract expires. Maxey, if you don't agree to an extension, and boy, is there, so you're transferring a lot of risk to him. That is, according to some, the original source of frustration between Kawhi Leonard and the Spurs. So you do have those things consider, but that's years down the road. Philly could really bring in, it would be easier for them to bring in a difference maker, probably not a max level guy, but like a high, you know, like a next level down guy in 24. But there are two problems with that. One, you need that player to sign on the dotted line, and it'd be hard because of their lack of assets to do it via sign and trade. And you, so like, there are going to be a lot of other options. And that means you're in many ways punting on 1 year of Joel Embiid's prime, which who knows if Joel Embiid is cool with that. But there are some juicy players, depending on how you want to see it, like OG Anunoby or Pascal Siakam, or like players like that who move the needle more than the 23 free agents, but you're making a real sacrifice to get to 24 while maintaining flexibility.
Yeah, and this is also a big opportunity for this season when Tyrese Maxey is only making $4 million. He's going to need a new contract after this. And to be able to build a team with Tyrese Maxey, Tobias Harris is a good player still. If Harden leaves, they need him from a creation standpoint. But it's also hard to see how this team is a championship contender without Harden. And yeah, so they're in a really interesting spot. And
One more other thing to mention. And I don't know what they would throw to Houston to make this happen, but structuring it as a sign and trade so they get a huge trade exception. Yeah. And you potentially even fold in the other acquisition as a part of it. So you don't even acquire the trade. Technically speaking, you do, but you make it all one deal. So player X, who is not a free agent, makes anywhere between like a low salary and what Harden will make on his new contract, because you don't have to worry about base year compensation or anything like that. Like, that would be another way to potentially add somebody. And in that circumstance, the other thing that opens up there is a potentially negative value or less positive contract. And so that way you could get a player who doesn't require as many assets, but might actually be a good player for you because of the threshold we were talking about with replacing Harden.
Now, maybe if you're going to bring back Harden, you think, okay, like, if we only go 3 years, that's a tradable deal when Maxey gets his new deal. Like, we'll still have some flexibility there. If you go to the fourth year, then it starts to get just at a point where it might be impossible to move. But Daryl, especially if Harden leaves, I mean, it's just going to take so much creativity to get a team that's as good as what they had this year in theory, which ultimately wasn't good enough. Although I still, a lot of that is matchup based, right? Like, if they'd gone up against Milwaukee, if they'd gotten to the finals and played Denver, I actually would have liked the way they matched up against Denver. But that's not what happened. They lost. It was ugly. They're looking for a new coach. I guess we didn't even mention that. I guess a lot of the usual names are out there. I mean, is there anyone coach-wise? I mean, is Nick Nurse, is that the guy you would be most interested in for them that's available? Like, they're talking Monty Williams. I'm not interested in Monty Williams if I'm them, because their big problem has been like these kind of emotional collapses, which Monty Williams has also presided over.
I like Nurse best on a deep team with a lot of defensive flexibility, creativity. There isn't a lot of defensive creativity. Maybe there's more than we think with Philly.
Melton, if they keep him around.
Embiid isn't scheme versatile. You could do the Robert Williams thing of having him, you know, have him guard a non-threat. Like they could do more of that. Philly did do that at some times to actually pretty good effect. Yeah. But like including against Denver, incidentally, in that matchup, which may have firmed up Joel Embiid's MVP. But there isn't as much there. And it also I think offensive creativity would be a fun thing for them. But I don't know how much that sort of whether you want to go as far as D'Antoni or somebody else would really change things for them, because their offense when their guys were available was pretty good.
Yeah. One other thing I think you might look at with them, maybe you could say Fred VanVleet would be someone that they could try to bring in this scenario we're talking about. Although the issue with getting a big trade exception for Harden and not cutting other salary is that then you also run into the first apron there. They would still, to get a guy in a sign and trade just to replace Harden at similar salary to him, they would have to cut elsewhere to fit under the first apron. That would probably be through Harris.
I have That's a cheaper player. Do you want me to just mention one name to throw out there if this happens?
Of course.
Terry Rozier.
Oh yeah, in a trade.
Yeah, because he doesn't make as much.
Small in the backcourt.
Would be, but he doesn't make as much. And Charlotte, especially if they end up drafting Scoot, they might not need him as much. So that might be a circumstance where you're kind of scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Doesn't cost a ton in the way of assets.
The other thing they maybe could go into is trying to find more of a bomber type to juice the offense, not the same type of player as Harden, but just to give you, they'll need more diversity, and they've never had they were a really good shooting team, but they've never had that great movement shooter. So maybe Max Strus is someone
since Redick?
Yeah, I guess it's been a while. I guess I was thinking about I guess he left in 19. So maybe a Gary Trent Jr. or a Jordan Clarkson would just be someone you could bring in that would have enough juice off the dribble to just give you one other place to attack offensively, and not going to duplicate what Harden gave you, but at least now there's more shooting around Embiid. You can kind of go more the Houston Olajuwon approach around Embiid with great shooting. I think that's about it on these guys. So it's probably as deep as we can go in this format.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Maxey's extension in other places, but the idea that I had about 24, that creates strain in a player team negotiation. There could be incentive to do it, and it also could be that the sides are just too far apart, especially with the salary cap rising. That's actually the one other CBA element that I wanted to bring up, is that the salary cap will not rise more than 10% in any given year. It's also not going to drop, but what that means is a spike isn't coming. And 10% of 134 million is a lot. So we could see some significant rises, but it's not going to be 20 or 30 million or something. And that would be important for Philly, because that would theoretically really save them in terms of those most expensive costs.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Okay, well, let's get to another team that is also in a very difficult financial situation, wasn't good enough in the second round of the playoffs. That is the Golden State Warriors. And we've been talking for many a year about the financial apocalypse that awaits them in this season. And that's because Jordan Poole kicks in at $28.7 million.
Whew.
The season, some of that may go down a little bit because there's unlikely as far as making the conference finals, NBA finals, he didn't make. So that'll go down a little bit. But the Warriors are more concerned about just what the actual payment is going to end up being.
Well, I have a place to set this table. It helps that I just wrote that piece for The Athletic with
Tim. Oh, great. Yeah.
is that I brought up $180 million as like that's the second, roughly the second apron line. And you're like, oh, that's a lot of money. And it is. When you count the Warriors' fully guaranteed players, the non-options, and the 19th pick in the 23 draft, which they have, that all those together is roughly $180 million. So that means the Warriors are at the second apron with $0 for Draymond Green, Dante DiVincenzo, and if they wanted to retain Lamb, Anthony Lamb, or Ty Jerome. So they're at this like the high bar without even keeping things close to the same team that they had. Like that would be a significantly worse Warriors team, and it would still be prohibitively expensive.
Let's talk about Draymond Green first here, and there's a possibility he could opt into that $27 million. Maybe they end up retaining him on a longer term deal for slightly less than that, as they did with Andrew Wiggins. It seems like it's pretty much assumed that he's going to be back. I don't know if they've negotiated that already, but Steve Kerr basically said, we're not a championship contender without him. There has been discussion that other teams might be interested in Green. I'm not sure who those, you know, is it Detroit trying to take a step forward? Like, does he really want to go play in Detroit, rejoin his old buddy James Wiseman over there and play with no spacing? He would help their defense. He would help any team's defense, but it's just, this is like the place where he fits the best.
Well, and the biggest problem for Green in many ways in this class is that if he wanted to be a difference maker on a very good team, it's the wrong group of teams that have cap space. Like, yes, there is a scenario where the Lakers cut everyone and have a lot of cap space, and then he'd be playing next to LeBron. Nitty. Also, there'd be some issues there in terms of front court rotation. But mostly the teams that have space this year, it's more in the line of like the Spurs and the Thunder. Like, the Spurs are in the early stages. They did get the pick that can become Wembanyama, and the Thunder, who are an exciting young team, but aren't there. Like, Draymond Green does not make them a championship contender. He would make them a much better team. And so
he's not interested in going there. They're not interested in having him in
there. Exactly. So the options for him, it's either, first of all, we don't know who would give him the kind of money should he be prioritizing that, but he can't have his cake and eat it too with anyone other than the Warriors, because those circumstances just don't really exist. And in maybe certain circumstances, a sign and trade could be on the table, but A, those teams, you know, that hard caps you and there aren't as many suitors. And also, we don't know how willing the Warriors would be to play ball with that.
Yeah, something along the lines of like 3 years, $75 million seems about right to me. And this is kind of not entirely, but mostly a one-year deal, because Klay Thompson is making $43 million and he's not going to make anywhere close to that after this year. So that's, and I don't think they're going to trade Klay Thompson. I don't think there would be a market for him. He also has his trade bonus, 15% trade bonus on that deal as well. But
just to give people an idea of that, I worked out, because I did some prognostications beyond this season when I was working on that piece with Kawakami, and the shorthand that I developed, like the basic understanding, was that so this is kind of the number to keep in mind. So this is for 24-25. That you could think about it that Poole, Thompson, and Green, if they combined make $68 million or less in 24-25, they might be okay with the second apron. And Poole's already making 31. So that means under that logic, Thompson and Green would need to combine for $37 million or less in order to make it work. Or you have to, you know, either you go over the second apron or you have to make some cuts. And so that's it. It's a good way of thinking about it kind of from a holistic standpoint. Now, we don't know how much Draymond's going to take. We don't know what Klay Thompson would be willing to do, which could also happen via an extension should the sides be willing to do it. So that's something it's a number to keep in mind.
Yeah. And it's hard to imagine that they would go over the second apron in 24-25 unless this team is just like an awesome championship contender. If they win it in 24, get to the finals, you know, hard fought loss in the conference finals type of thing. My guess is actually that Klay is not going to get done unless it's for like a crazy discount. And I think he's going to look back at his season and think that he can do better than that. And maybe the Warriors will say, all right, great, I hope you do, and we'll pay you if you do. If not, we're not going to go there. But it seems like it has to be a pool trade at this point. I don't see how else they can get out of this financial pickle. But we're also talking about having to upgrade the roster. Like if they move on from Poole, they already had this huge issue with not enough diversity and ways to attack. Part of that was because Klay and Poole were terrible in that Lakers series and through large swaths even to that Kings series that Steph kind of single-handedly roped them through in the end. But like Jordan Poole does serve an important function on this team. And so they'll have to figure out a way to replace that if he... What was that number again for 24-25 that they have below the second apron?
Roughly $68 million, and Poole's making 31.
Right, so that's with Draymond, Poole, and Klay. You're opting in like Gary Payton into his and deal.
Looney. And Looney has a partial guarantee.
And Kuminga.
It was just a really preliminary, just like game in and out.
No, I got you. I just wanted to know what the assumptions were. And I mean, they also, like Joe Lacob has already said that this team is going to be, like he's not necessarily willing to go to this $400 million range, which is exactly where right now, if they keep Draymond at $27 million, then it's $450 million in team salary plus repeater tax. The new tax number, as we said in the opening, those don't kick in until 25-26, when presumably things will be much different. Now, could they cut elsewhere along the market, right? Would they move Gary Payton the second? Would they try to move on from Kuminga? Like you're not going to trade Kuminga, presumably, unless you're getting a guy who's making a lot of money as well. I mean, can you package Poole and Kuminga and get back something that is better than those guys and also makes less? But then that guy, I think it seems like they need like more another versatile wing, but then they're going to be light again on offensive creation. So then they have to just find someone on the cheap to do that. But then that guy's not going to be able to defend. I think like so much of when I think about this team goes back to, they got to just get more out of these guys, right? They got to get more out of Moses Moody. They got to get more out of Kuminga. Like have Kuminga actually making $6 million actually fulfill that wing role. And I mean, is it possible that they just go into next season with Poole still there and Draymond on a new deal, or Draymond opted in, and then they just try to figure it out at the deadline? Or, maybe Payton gets injured and they can pay off to move off of him. I mean, what do they have in terms of picks that they can trade as sweeteners?
Again, the story isn't super positive because the Warriors, that first round pick that they traded to Memphis to offload Andre Iguodala's contract, that's finally coming home to roost in either 24, if it's outside of the top four, and then it's what top one protected in 25, unprotected in 26. They do not owe any firsts beyond that. So that, and I would assume that teams would be reasonably confident that Warriors pick would convey in 24. So then first allowable draft language would be 26. And so in order to trade two firsts, it would have to be, first allowable draft language, but you could theoretically do it.
They could actually trade four picks, because they could trade this 23 first, whoever it is after the draft.
Once it's made.
Right. And then, 24 and 25 are probably locked up due to the stepping rule, but then you could do 26, 28, and 30. In theory, maybe you just get the
team wouldn't be sure that they would get all of them, but they could be, they'd have some confidence. Then it'd have to be unprotected, which would be wild.
Yeah. So that, and now then you throw Poole and Kuminga in. Does that get you like a star to come in with these guys? We don't know who might become available there. But they certainly have the assets. Even if you'd say, all right, Poole's a negative contract and we're trading him in his nadir and teams aren't going to want, like they have the assets to just get off of Poole and maybe even get back something that's semi-reasonable. I mean, one of the things that occurred to me, although they already have Colin Sexton, who's on a better contract and pretty similar to Poole, would be, moving Poole to Utah and getting back Jordan Clarkson or something like that. Now that Clarkson would have to opt in, they are way over the first apron, so they can't get a guy in a sign and trade. But a deal like that where you move Poole, just get a kind of score type who's on a shorter, cheaper contract, but can hopefully give you a little something as a third guard. And, frankly, given what Poole gave him in the playoffs, it wouldn't take much to exceed his production. But maybe they also say, hey, Jordan Poole just needs to be better. We think he can be better, and we're just going to roll with him. And then, hey, maybe we'll trade him at the deadline if we have to. But I guess the other issue then, Danny, is if you want to get your salary down, you really, especially under this new regime now where the minimum salary, like you're not going to have teams going into the season with like $30 million in cap space. And maybe like, I don't think there's going to be anyone rolling in with like a $28 million trade exception. So if you want to like significantly get your salary down, you probably need to do it in the offseason. And so I don't know if they're just moving pool and significantly reducing your team salary. That would be tough. What if
I hadn't thought about it. The chronology of transactions, like you're completely right that the calendar of shedding salary now is completely different. Like it basically has to happen by October.
It should be noted though that if they wanted to just move on from Gary Payton II for nothing, that would actually get them down to $382 million. And that's in theory something that Joe Lacob would be willing to pay. That would save them $70 million in tax and salary to just dump $9 million of Gary Payton II. Now, of course, they also wouldn't have DiVincenzo necessarily either. We could talk about him briefly. What do you foresee his market being? Because the most the Warriors could give him would be $5.4 million. You know, maybe presumably that would be another 1+1. I like DiVincenzo. We talked about him in the shooting guard, so I think he actually could be like a budget starting shooting guard option for some of these teams. And I would think that his market would be around the mid-level the way he played this year, but maybe that's just not going to be true.
I think that teams should consider him around the non-taxpayer mid-level. That's 12.2. It wouldn't surprise me if he was some. So the room exception is 7.6, and then that 12.2. And depending on who has it available, it could also be through cap space. Like it doesn't have to be with one of those teams. Something in the 7 to 12 million range seems very reasonable. And DiVincenzo, I could see, considering like his pathway to this point, totally justified for him to prioritize financial security. You know, if you can get that lined up, he probably thought he was going to have that after his rookie scale deal. When remember, he was starting on the Bucks the year they won the championship, but then he got hurt and missed the most of the playoff.
People were talking about him being, you know, making something in the high teens.
Exactly. And so that, you know, if I were a team that needed star depth, and especially if you can get somebody who is probably best as a third guard, but has starting upside, like if you could get that for $12 million with where the cap is going, you jump on that stuff. And so there are a number of different teams. Like there aren't that many franchises that are going to have the full non-taxpayer available, like for sure. But I'm going to give a team that probably people aren't really thinking of. But if Toronto lets Gary Trent Jr. Go, DiVincenzo is kind of like a versatile guy who could fit in a couple slots. I think he'd be a good fit for them.
Yeah, we just don't know what's going to happen with some of these teams either as we go back to the idea of like how they could improve the team. I mean, I think a Poole, Kuminga, and up to 4 first round picks, including 19 in this year's draft, like that's a pretty powerful package. It's just it's not clear what's going to be available. And would that be, you know, we know that they tried to get OG Anunoby. I don't know how extensive that was at last year's trade deadline. Is that something that they would want to go after and maybe save a little bit money? You know, if Toronto just loses Fred VanVleet, would they want to try to get someone like Pascal Siakam and just like play him next to Draymond? Is that something that they would consider? I mean, I think something is going to happen like this. I'm predicting this is going to be a wild offseason. And I think that it was floated, for example, like a Drew Holiday trade. And I don't think that's, you know, Poole for Holiday is something that Milwaukee would be too interested in. But now if you threw in like Kuminga and Poole and some picks or something like that, would that get it there? I still probably don't think so. They're just, it seems like Miami is going to be trying to cut salary. There are, how hilarious would it be if it was like Poole for Tyler Hero? But all right, I'm starting to just spitball here a little too much.
Well, I think your idea, going back to an earlier concept of hoping that their existing players do better, that also ties in with the general optimism that front offices feel, and whether it is Bob Myers making those decisions or somebody else, which I presume would be Mike Dunleavy, if that's the way. If Myers isn't there, I think it's going to be an in-house replacement. So Moody, Kuminga, healthier Gary Payton II, like that, those sorts of things. And then if you have to make an adjustment, so like you're making the financial decision in the offseason because it's too hard to make that change after, but you're making the personnel evaluation, you could incorporate what happens in the season a little bit more aggressively.
Yeah, and a lot just comes down to what Joe Lacob is willing to pay. If he's okay in the $380 million, then maybe they're like, all right, we could just move on from Gary Payton if we have to. But it seems like they brought Payton back to have him be part of the team going forward too. And of course the Draymond thing, who knows what he's going to sign for. If he ends up like, I mean, I don't think he would take something less than 25. And I'm sure also he knows exactly what Jordan Poole is making and isn't going to want to make too much less than him, if less than him at all. But it does seem like there's been a feeling that the two timeline thing hasn't worked and they just have to do everything they can to just keep this going with Steph, and they'll just kind of deal with the consequences of it later to some degree. And maybe Joe Lacob will note that with Clay making the 43 and that's going to come down significantly, I'll just suck it up and deal with it. And yeah, because there's just these two components of needing to get better offensively, also probably needing to get better defensively at the guard position. Like those Lakers guards who aren't even that great completely cooked them. So a lot of that is through Jordan Poole. Jordan Poole is their biggest defensive problem and probably their biggest offensive problem too. Are they going to just hope that he gets better, or are they going to really be aggressive with that salary slot and try to improve and either get back to the same level of defensive versatility that they had in the past, or just get one more scorer who's really awesome? And it's because they really, like, the other thing is the regular season too. Like, they desperately needed what Jordan Poole gave them in the regular season. Like, they managed to go 500 without Steph, and he was solid enough in those times. So if they move on from Poole, they got to find a way to replace him. And it seems weird to me that you would say that this team that's this old would be like, hey, we just rely on internal improvement. We think all these guys could be better next year. But maybe that is the best. Like, okay, maybe we're just going to say Klay Thompson isn't going to go 3-19 in our final game of the season next year. And that's the way our team's built. We just got to rely on that.
Entirely
anything
possible.
Else on these guys?
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, that will do it. We'll be back later tonight with playback for game 3 of Miami and Boston. And of course, the pod after that. And we'll be getting into these off seasons very shortly here. Talk to y'all soon.
Hope you enjoyed that free episode of Dunked On. If you want more of this coverage, the playoff coverage, the off season coverage, and my daily dunk, Seth Partnow's written analysis, monthly chats on Discord with Nate, Danny, Seth, and myself. If you want access to the Discord community, lots of great conversations happening there every day. Our salary cap sheets, all of that you can get by subscribing to Dunked On Prime. That's dunkedon.supportingcast.fm. dunkedon.supportingcast.fm.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.